common enough that in companies, you know, there's a lot of cases where data just kind of makes you feel more confident about decisions that you were sort of taking, or maybe there's a mild iteration.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of How to Product, a podcast series on product management, brought to you by PM School and your host, Arjav Jain. This podcast series is focused on bringing in product leaders from across the globe and creating valuable content on product management for our listeners with a key focus on early in-career product professionals. I'm excited to bring a whole new set of episodes this time around, speaking to some of the most prominent names in the global and the Indian product landscape. Let's dive straight into the episode. I have with me Shalvi Vaklu, former senior director, head of data at Strava. She's held multiple positions in her 15-year-long career so far with various organizations, all in the field of data and analytics. Some notable ones are Salesforce, Fitbit, Komodo Health, and Monster. Shalvi has made creating value in the world of data and self-advocacy her life mission, and she's not leaving any stone unturned. She's soon launching her first book, Self-Advocacy, Your Guide to Getting What You Deserve at Work. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, so thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into talking about data, are you getting enough sleep before your book launch? I'm sure it's an exciting and a nervous time, so...
Barely, you know, just about. This is my first book, so I don't know how other people do it, but I've been a bag of nerves for the last few weeks.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to turn out great. So good luck for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I hope I get a copy of it. I'll get my hand on it and then I'll definitely give it a read, right?
Yeah.
So awesome. So before we dive in, we want to get to sort of know the human before the product leader, data leader that you are. So what book are you currently reading?
So funny fact, I am actually reading my own book right now because I just got a proofreading copy yesterday, so my editor has asked me to read it, you know, for the 15th time and make sure there's no mistakes before we hit publish.
I'm sure. Just 15th? I'm surprised that number is at 15.
just in the last week.
Fair. Okay, that makes more sense. So another one quickly. So what's the best advice someone's given you?
Don't care about what other people think, you know, don't put too much value in what other people think, which I think is advice gold.
Interesting. Okay. And just quickly, what do you do outside of work? Like, what's your top hobby at the moment, apart from your book?
I love plants. So I have about like more than 60 plants in my apartment. My apartment's not honestly that big. So I just love plants and propagating them and having them around the house.
That's awesome. And how does that work when you're off on vacations?
Oh, there's a whole setup. There's a whole, there's a technology component to it. There's a relationship component to it on who comes and fills up buckets. But my husband and I had actually traveled for 40 days and it was a whole thing for us to figure out how to water those 60 plants. And that's actually when I counted them. I was like, oh, that's a lot of plants.
Awesome. Cool. So there's so much that I want to talk to you about. So quickly getting in. So as we really delve into the realm of product analytics, right? Could you provide our listeners with a brief overview of what really product analytics is and how it impacts the role of a product manager throughout the whole life cycle of a product?
Yeah. So I love product analytics. I've been in it for a really long time. And essentially, product analytics is analytics that is focused on the improvement and the optimization of the product. So that, you know, you do that by actually analyzing, like, hey, I have a product. Who is actually using it? How are they adopting it? You break it down into the granularity of individual features that make up the product. And you really try to understand, like, you know, what's the user behavior? What's the user engagement? How are real people using the product? And how do you actually use that to validate direction and pick where your future strategy is going to be? Like, you know, and how do you focus on like those one metrics that help you improve your business? So I think for product managers, it's a very, very essential tool. And again, you know, by tool, I mean like product analytics resources are something that you need to invest in. You maybe have a mix of tools that you use or analytics partners that you work with, but to be able to do that effectively, you kind of need to think about that entire life cycle. So, you know, what you said, like there's a life cycle of the product. And so before you launch a product, you want to make sure that you are coming up with good signals from the existing product. Like, what is the existing product telling you about what users want and what you need to build? And during the launch of a product, you focus on sort of, you know, experimenting to try to quantify the impact of that new product. You want to make sure that you measure and track all the usage details, that your experiments are telling you something meaningful. And after you have launched the product, you want to make sure that you continue to track and visualize things like product adoption, to make sure that you can course correct if something's not going according to plan, and that you can actually pivot and rebuild based on that product analytics data that you're getting.
Awesome. Golden advice. And funny story, during my time at Byju's, my team was responsible for launching a product, and we wanted to do a beta test. So we sent out some physical devices with our app on it to the users' houses. And what we realized is we did not deploy the analytics SDK into the app. So we had no idea of when people launched the app and how they got activated. We struggled. And then we were in a position where we could do an OTA update, but us that golden sort of like initial launch to activation data. Then we picked up new users, sent it to them, tried to get that data again. But golden advice.
Yeah, and data once lost, it's gone.
Yeah. So great sort of summary, right, as to what product analytics is and how it helps product managers. Let's dive a little bit deeper. And this question is coming from personal experience. Recently, I was trying to sort of work on identifying some metrics to measure the success of what we're building and tying it to the North Star metric, right? Like that's sort of the way to approach it. But almost everything I could think of were lagging indicators. And I sat down to ask myself, hey, we really need leading indicators in this, right? So could you talk a little bit about what are lagging and what are leading indicators, and why it's important to pick leading indicators, and any tips you have to actually pick these leading indicators?
Yeah, great topic. I think, let me actually start by just kind of defining these two terms. So, you know, like you mentioned, both indicators are useful when you think about measuring success. And a leading indicator essentially predicts future results, and a lagging indicator reports past results. So a simple example could be something like a subscription product. You know, I love subscription products, by the way. So, but yeah, something like, say, Netflix, Spotify. So a lagging indicator would be, you know, you're trying to measure like success. You say like, how many actual subscribers did I get, or what was my revenue? So those are things that only once they're done, there's no sort of changing them. But a leading indicator might be, how many people actually signed up for a trial for my product? You know, it's a function, and like some of them will convert. How many monthly active users did I have? How many daily active users did I have? We know in subscription businesses that more people finding value in a product, using it, are eventually going to convert into subscribers or stay as subscribers if they're already paying. So that's sort of the difference. Like, leading indicators give you enough reaction time to try to do something. Like, you know, if you're tracking monthly active users, for example, which is an indicator of eventually how many people are gonna keep paying you money, you can react to that faster. Like, you can see your active users changing, and if that suddenly drops, you already can predict that, hey, you know, my subscriber number might drop, like, if people are not finding value right now. So it gives you a lot more reaction time, and that's why there's that, you know, picking leading indicators is really important, because you can't change the past, but you can alter the future if you already kind of predict where it's sort of going.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and I would say the trick that I have for sort of picking metrics is I try to break down almost everything into an equation. So, you know, pick a North Star metric, like let's say X is what you're optimizing for, like come up with that equation. Like, what does that equation look like? Like, you know, is it A times B plus C equals to X, or A plus B plus C, whatever. Like, you know, I'm oversimplifying it, obviously. But like, try to break it down into, okay, what makes you add up to that? And then try to keep breaking it down further, like learn more about your business. What is A? What is B? Is there an equation that adds up to A or B or something like that? So I think it really helps to kind of keep understanding those equations and improving them a little bit better. And also sort of thinking about the funnel, that if you think of a lagging metric, really just think what comes before it. It's maybe something that's correlated, like maybe it's not an exact causation, but at least it tells you what happens before, which is likely to make that other metric happen later.
Very interesting, especially the whole thinking of a funnel and thinking of what comes before this metric. In my head, it seems very sort of, it makes a lot of sense when you put it that way, right? Are there specific industries where lagging indicators work better than leading? Or?
Yeah, actually, I think, I feel like lagging indicators sometimes get a bad rap because they're after the fact, and so you can't really do much. But they are your only real source of truth. Like if you're trying to say I want to know my, like, you know, I want to increase the amount of revenue that I get, the final proof of the pudding is only once you actually have that final number of this is my revenue, these are my number of subscribers. And so I do think that it helps to not completely discard it. Like, I think when you are trying to figure out how you can optimize your business, you should be looking at leading indicators, but the lagging indicators are important. You have to keep looking at them to make sure that all your predictions or all your optimizations actually resulted in what you thought they were going to. So it helps you recalibrate even your hypothesis, even how you thought about the business, like all the efforts that you did it actually move that final number that you were trying to move? I think especially like I think there's a lot of industries where that final number does matter. It's not directional. Like, I have worked in software businesses for my entire career, but healthcare, for example, you need to know that final number. You need to care about that. You need to obsess about that final number, and that's how you add accountability in a lot of these pieces.
Makes a lot of sense. So moving on from choosing a metric to then sort of estimating the impact, right? So estimating the impact of a feature before it's launched can be a challenging task, right? So from your experience, what strategies and analytical methods can product managers really use to make accurate predictions about how a feature will influence that targeted metric that you've chosen?
Yeah, I think, I think good PMs, and I would say good product teams in general, are very good at sort of understanding the status quo really well. And I mean that about like almost every piece of it, right? Like, what is your current product doing? Do I really understand my users? I think starting with that deep knowledge built about the status quo, like, do you understand the reality of your problem? Like, you know, have you made up the problem because it's one that you are keen to solve, or do your customers really care about it? Do you know how to find the right customers? Do you know how to find the people who want that to be solved, and then you're making a very conscious decision to build it? Do you know how you're making money? Do you know how you're not making money? So I think all of that, like, the more familiar you get with the customer, the more you almost can be in their shoes and really understand what's going on. You develop that empathy where you like, and this is sort of the non-data piece of, like, yeah, you know, just have that customer empathy where you can really understand that real problem that it's going to solve and what that impact is going to look like. but dive into specific data that you have, like, do you have comparable features? Do you have comparable launches that you have done in the past that can help you kind of figure out what that adoption is going to look like, what that impact is going to look like? And, you know, it doesn't, I mean, honestly, the comparable products don't even have to be your own. They can be somebody else's. So, like, we, when I worked at Strava, for example, like, we did some things which we're like, hey, there's other social networks that have done this before. Mm-hmm. And how did their launches go? And how did, you know, how did this roll out for them? Like, obviously, it's not an exact comparison, but I think it can help you sort of give those guiding directions. But start with that good hypothesis, have that in-depth UX research that's done to really know, like, what you're investing in. And then, like, everything you launch, like, develop your ability to run really good and robust experiments. That is how you quantify. That is how you sort of, if you're conflicted about directions, that is how you pick direction. But yeah, most importantly, that is how you validate that you thought this was going to happen. You know, you test it out on a smaller scale. And then when you go big, you are more confident that it's going to yield in what you really thought it would.
Interesting. So I hear there's a lot of, like, I want to say non-tangible, more sort of empathy sort of side of things, which lead into you building confidence into actually estimating and putting in numbers. Right? Very interesting take. And so we've spoken about analytics offering really valuable insights, and we just spoke about how there is the empathy aspect of it, right? And so a product manager's intuition also offers a lot of insights. Now, how can these two aspects be effectively balanced when making critical decisions, especially when dealing with uncertainty or incomplete data? And sometimes it's like, hey, data is telling us something, but intuition is telling us something else. So, like, you have ways in which you've tackled this in the past, or?
Yeah, that's a very interesting topic, because I think I've definitely been in situations where people were surprised that I, as like, I've been the head of data in two different companies, and as the sort of data leader, I still place a lot of importance on PMs who bring great intuition to the table. And I'll explain, like, why that is and what I mean by that. Like, you know, if I get the sense that the PM is relying on some, you know, magic bird that sits on their shoulder and tells them what to do, like, okay, cool, then I don't care. You know, that doesn't have the same effect. But what I really value is people whose intuition has been honed by the amount of experience that they have sort of developed in a certain domain, the customer obsession that they've had, where they've really sort of spent a lot of time trying to understand the customer, looking at data points that help them validate what they know to be true about the customer, by really having a very, very sharp focus on business value, and by knowing exactly what growth strategies work and not. Like, you know, these are things that they can't be. It's absorbing a lot of data, a lot of different times, focused on a lot of tiny things. But I think together that builds that intuition that I think some product managers have, which is really great. And I think the balance part of that is that, you know, sometimes you're in that great situation where you have a lot of data, like you have a lot of data available. It's giving you a clear signal. Uh-huh. And in those situations, I hope you trust the data and do what it tells you to do.
Right.
And I think the intuition part is where you don't have enough data. Like, maybe you don't really have a lot of data points that can help you pick direction with confidence. And in those cases, like, for the sake of your business, I hope you have a PM with great intuition, because that's kind of all you're going to get, right? So I think it's also like, what is the data availability? And I guess, you know, to your point, like, there are maybe going to be certain situations where maybe there is data available, or like, whatever, the confidence you have in the data availability is 60%, and the intuition is also 60%. Like, there's no slam dunk either ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, those are interesting situations. Like, I would say on a case-by-case basis, you would pick if they're in conflict. If they're in agreement, great. You have no problem. But if they're not in agreement, you pick, but you go back and actually recalibrate on what was actually true. Like if the data was saying something and the intuition was saying something, and then whichever direction you went up with, you know, what was the final result? And like, what can you learn about either recalibrating your intuition or recalibrating your data that helps you sort of do better next time? So I am a huge fan of like actually recording those times when you kind of just took a decision. But like, be like, what other signals were there that were either that backed up the decision I took or didn't back up, and they were right? And that way you can kind of recalibrate, because I think every company also has its own a little flavor of what kind of, you know, semi data is available, or what kind of semi intuition do you have, which can help you decide.
Right. And do you have any interesting sort of story from when you relied on intuition over data, since you spoke about you actually giving a lot of value to PMs with intuition?
Yeah, I definitely feel like, I think in my previous company, it was a consumer company, like it was consumer tech. And, you know, honestly, in consumer tech, it's there's a lot of opinions that people have, because especially like at a company like Strava, for example, a lot of people who worked there were users of the product, you know, so they were users of Strava themselves. And sometimes it was very clear that when people had suggestions, they're like, no, this is what people want. I'm like, no, that's what you want.
Right.
You are the active, you know, runner or cyclist, and so that's what you want. But that is not what the data says. Like, the data says, like, you know, whatever, X number of people do not care about this. Mm-hmm. So, like, it was easy to debunk some of those sort of personal aspirations disguised as intuitions. But then there were other pieces where, honestly, we didn't know. Like, you know, we're trying something completely mm-hmm. new, completely different. We have no data to go off of. And in that case, sometimes we really did take a call. We're like, do we have data proxies that can help us pick a direction? Mm-hmm. And if we really don't, or we have them, but they're not that sharp, let's go with what people feel. And but we still ask, like, you know, we're like, try to break down your intuition. Like, why do you feel this? Right. So back to the magic bird on the shoulder example, like, if someone cannot articulate why they reasonably think, like, you know, maybe they pull up something they knew about mm-hmm. our customer research from the past, or maybe, like, they have to give certain examples of, like, you know, I'm trying to break down what my intuition is saying, but it's based on these things. And you kind of take a call of what sounds reasonable enough. And sometimes it worked. Sometimes it didn't. Like, you know, we didn't nail it. But I think, again, like I said, the important piece is you go back and you recalibrate, and you like say that, okay, was my intuition based on something good, or did I just sort of make that up?
Mm-hmm. Do you think there could be a playbook for this, or it's very contextual and it depends on the scenario of when to go after your intuition versus when to go after data?
Ooh, that's such a wow. I think there could be, you know what? Uh-huh. Like, now that you say it, I feel like there could be. Like, I think you could possibly come up with a checklist of, you know, what is intuition? For the most part, it is a lot of like little bits of data that you've seen over time, and you're kind of like just sort of it's merging together in your brain, like you can't pinpoint it. And I feel like you could actually try to break that down into specific steps, like, okay, what does the past user research say? Like, what do your competitors do, or something like that? Like, I feel there is a playbook in there somewhere. Maybe you and I can collaborate and create one.
Sure, yeah. No, this, like, as you were saying this, my mind was also thinking of this. Like, hey, you broke it down quite well in terms of what does it take to understand status quo? What does it take? Like, what does it take to build intuition? So I'm like, hey, there probably is somewhere like a checklist.
For sure. I would say domain-specific checklist, 100%. Like, I worked in healthcare a little bit, and, you know, people who worked in healthcare for a long time, like, they really understand that space very, very well. And I see those examples that, you know, people who've just been with the same domain of problem for a very long time, like, their intuition seems to be better, but it's really their experience. Like, it's just that they've seen like 10 different versions of the same thing, and they can kind of aggregate that in their head and articulate it in a way that sounds reasonable.
Makes sense. Like, I think I've been in edtech for over 4 years, and I can see that, you know, over the course of these 4 years, I have built sort of like a stronger intuition on some things that I know will work, and have validated that with data as well eventually. But what do you say makes sense, right? Industry specific, you can probably get down and really create that that checklist or a playbook.
Makes sense.
So moving on from intuition, right? And especially like examples of consumer apps like Strava, I'm sure there's a lot of data that you guys get, right? So there is, when there's a wealth of data, there is like product managers can face the analysis paralysis, right? So could you share some strategies to help product managers focus on the most relevant data points and avoid getting overwhelmed by the sheer volume of data that's available?
You know, it's great. Like right now, if you look at the companies that are going, or I guess the new startups that are forming. So I feel like a few years back, everything was about business intelligence. Like every person and their mother was coming out with a new business intelligence tool, because there was a thing of like, all the data should be available self-service to you all the time.
Yeah.
And it'd be on your fingertips. And there were all these like catchy phrases with that. And it's interesting because, you know, if I had a dime for every time someone told me they wanted all the data and then they said, okay, there's too much data, I can't see the signal, like, yeah, maybe I'd be ready for it. but I think focusing on the right data is first and foremost a problem about do you have good decision making, and do you know how to make that decisions? Like, are you disciplined about how you make decisions? And this is a topic that I feel I place a high degree of importance in it, because I have seen companies that thrive or fail solely on the basis of how good is their leadership team in making decisions. Do they have a process? Are they clear about it? Is everybody on the same page? And are you making an effort to make sure that everybody's on the same page? So for me, like, I've done this, I think, in, you know, multiple companies. Like, Salesforce has this format called a V2 MOM, which is sort of similar to an OKR, but you can look it up. It's called, like, you know, you define a vision, values, measures, obstacles, and I'm blanking on the last M, methods. Yeah. So you actually define like what your any project, any or big picture, like the whole company goals or something. But you actually define like those very, very individual pieces, and you try to make sure that everybody in the team or in the company, like whatever level that V2 MOM is defined at, understands it. So every word is important. Every, you know, if you do not acknowledge what obstacles you're going to have in solving your problem upfront, how are you going to solve them? Like, maybe somebody doesn't even think of that obstacle, but you know, it's sort of like almost this thing of having an agreement before you actually do something about what it is that you're going to do and how you're going to solve trade-offs. That if there is a trade-off when you're building your product about speed and accuracy, what are you going to choose? Like, it really matters to have those pieces in place. And the reason that I say that this is, you know, this is sort of the first step to you picking the right data is because if you don't align on what you're supposed to do, how do you know how you're going to measure success? How do you know what data actually leads you to measure success? Like, you know, you're going to keep picking those same vanity metrics that all the teams are picking, which have nothing to do with your building. So I really feel that time spent upfront in making sure that everybody is super clear about what you're trying to do, everybody's super clear about how you will, you know, if the data shows you this, or if like whatever you roll out the product, like if the results are this, you will do this. And if the results are something else, you will do something else. Like if you don't align on all those pieces, I think it causes a lot of heartache. And then what happens is that by that time, people are already, they've already made up their mind about what they're going to do. And then they just find data to fit that narrative. And that is super common, right? Like people are like, well, I already know I'm going to build this.
Yeah.
And so I'm just going to find me the data that like can prove that this is the right thing to do. And that's not correct, right? Like you don't want to have data to retrofit the solution. You want the solution to be based on what the data is suggesting you do.
Yeah, I'm guilty of doing that too, right? Where as a PM, honestly, we're like, hey, my intuition tells me that we should build this. And now can I find data to support this? So, but what if the data does tell you that, hey, okay, yes, it makes sense. And that's when that whole intuition sort of data conversation comes up. But I didn't know about this V2 mom. I'm going to look this up and probably do some reading on this. But sometimes when you're looking at data, you ask yourself, hey, okay, you probably get another signal, and then you have to go and dive into another whole database or a set of data points. And you tend to get into this rabbit hole of, hey, okay, let me look at that signal. Let me look at this signal. Is there like a whole parallel set of data that I need to look at, which is complementing this data? So it's like, at what point do you tell yourself that, hey, okay, I have enough signals. I don't need to sort of dive deeper into this anymore.
Oh, 100%. I would say that if, I used to train all my analysts to have not just PMs, but any stakeholder actually like put it in writing, like what decision is going to change if they actually get some data. So if it's not going to change any decision, if it is just a curiosity, and people start actually thinking about it, like, honestly, a lot of times people say like, I'll just feel better if I knew this information.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, you know, your better has a cost though. Like your feeling better has a cost. Like it's going to take my analyst like 3 hours to pull up this information. And, you know, we'd love to have it like available out of the box. But I think that's a good way that people can just rein themselves in, that if they're not going to change direction, if they're not going to do something different, like almost like say that, okay, I'm asking this question. If this is the answer, I'll do this. And if this is the answer, I will do that. If the answer is the same, you're still going to do whatever you're going to do. Honestly, like you should just stop and focus more of your energy on making the rollout a success.
Makes sense. And I think this is a takeaway for me here, where I'm going to ask myself what decision I'm going to change based on this new piece of data I go to my analyst for. So that's awesome. But what I hear is just be super clear about what you're going to do with this data, and based on what this data is going to tell you, what action you're going to take, right? And once you have that chalked out, you can steer clear of this analysis paralysis that you could get into.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And you know, it's normal. Like I think I feel like all companies almost go through this like little sinusoidal curve that first they have no data, they're not interested in data, then you start showing them a little bit of data, and then slowly the interest builds, and then it almost becomes like they're interested in all data all the time.
Yeah.
And then they're like, okay, it's too much, I'm just going to rely on like my own judgment, and then they kind of start ignoring the data. So then again, the data investment drops, the reliance on data drops. So it almost like, I think it's a very predictable thing for companies to kind of go through these ups and downs.
Okay.
And the best way that people can kind of keep it to reasonable levels is for the most important decisions in the company, at least you should have that that robust process where you really try to figure out like what data is required to make this decision the best success that it can. And I think it is incumbent on product teams to show that value of what happens when they use data to make good decisions. Like, you know, give examples, like try to quantify, like, you know, we use data to make these decisions. And if we had just based it on our like existing, the way we were already doing it, like this is the delta, like try to quantify it. People love numbers. Like when you tell them, save them like $1 million, people love that. They'll never forget it.
Awesome. All right. So I'm sure in your long sort of career across companies, I'm sure you have an example where data significantly changed the direction in which you were initially headed, right? And maybe an example like this could actually help our listeners understand what data can do for them and for their products and eventually for the companies.
It is pretty common enough that in companies, there's a lot of cases where data just kind of makes you feel more confident about decisions that you were sort of taking, or maybe there's a mild iteration. But I would say, like at Strava, for example, I won't tell you what specifically changed about the strategy. That's confidential. But sure. I will say this, that we did a 3-year strategy mapping when shortly after I joined, like within 6 months after I joined, which is a long time in a startup. That's a really long time. And we did like a very deep analysis of our growing user base, what sports, what combinations, what demographics, like all of those pieces. And I would definitely admit that most of us going into that analysis, there were two of us who were the primary people who were pairing off on it, but we spoke to a lot of other people in the company. And I would say most of us had certain assumptions about what we were expecting to sort of see as our focus areas for our strategy in the next 3 years. But I will say that the data was really clear. Like there was this very underserved area that, it wasn't unimportant. It was just like we were not, as a company, we were not looking at it as closely. And after we did that, strategy mapping, like the analysis was super clear. We're like, we are way under investing in this certain sort of group of our customers who are clearly all the metrics that you'd care about, like what's the total addressable market for it, what's the growth rate, what's the sort of usage from people who are existing, like all of it was just it was off the charts. Like it was very clear that that is the area that we really needed to invest in. And I would say, like, if we had not done that, like not given those proof with the numbers, that might have still been an area that we had, but we would not have had that level of investment. So I wouldn't call it like direction of the company is completely changed, but I would say that we very heavily optimized on something that could make us a lot more money, which otherwise it was money left on the table probably if we hadn't done that. And I would say that this is super common. Like I think in most companies I've worked at, like there've been these sort of nuggets that you find where you're like, hey, I didn't even think about this, and the data is so clear. At Fitbit, that happened a bunch of times where we look at people's information or like look at people's customer support requests and be like, oh, hey, everybody seems to be talking about this. Like, why aren't we being more active in addressing this problem?
Right. So I think an insight like that can only really come out when you invest a lot of time in seeing all different cohorts of users, behaviors across. And maybe a tip here for product managers is just not just look at your surface level product analytics, but really dive deep into seeing how different users are using your product. And if there's like a group of users who probably has a much higher attention, much higher engagement rates that you can capitalize on. And I think it's along the lines of what you guys did. So dive deep into data and see what insights you can uncover. But yeah, great example, especially for a company like Strava, which is doing great, like identifying that untapped market I'm sure has great impact. Awesome. So I'm sure you've worked with a lot of product managers, right? So want to get a sense of what skills you appreciate as a data leader in PMs that you work with, and what tips you have for any aspiring professionals who want to really acquire these skills and become great PMs.
I love working with PMs, who are sort of curious about their craft and like really interested in growing their skills. I think, I especially have also worked in B2B businesses and B2C businesses, and I think PMs have slightly different sort of ways of working and all. But the one thing that stays constant is I think product managers who stay honest to the business and to the business goals do really well. Like I love working with people like, these are the PMs who are not they're not going after the shiny objects. You know, they're not suggesting that we build out a feature or launch a new product because it is the hip new thing to do, or it is something that they love to see on their resume. But rather, they're doing it because it is the best thing for the business. And if, you know, PMs who can articulate that business value of like, this is what this product or this feature is going to unlock for us from a business perspective, like that articulation has to be super strong. And, you know, you can't fake that. Like the thing that I said earlier, like, you can't first decide the solution and then find the data that kind of reaches up to that. Like, you have to really like go back to first principles and say that, you know, this is what is truly, truly sort of valuable. And I think PMs who want to acquire those skills, like, again, you know, you have to spend a lot of time like understanding the business. You have to really care a lot about the business goals, but really excel at doing that. And I think you can do that by focusing a lot of energy on spending like cross-functional time with a lot of different people. So I think product management is a very cool role where you work with almost everybody. Like, you are going to work with engineers, you're going to work with data people, you're going to work with marketers, you're going to work across the company if there's one person you know who's going to interact with everybody. But like, really, like, use those relationships as learning opportunities. You know, what is the engineering perspective on things? What is the marketing perspective on things? What is the finance perspective on things? And how can you use that to become better at your craft? And one, understand the limitations of your company and like where it's at, but also leverage the gifts that exist in your company about like what different people have, and what different people have this very interesting knowledge about certain pieces that you can try to leverage for the betterment of the business.
Yeah, and great advice. I think from my recent experience, right, having a conversation with someone in marketing, and this is, I think, as of this week, I really unlocked this new idea of how teachers, in my case, really behave, or rather gather new information, and where they really learn about these tools. And that helped me sort of maybe think of new flows that I can build in my product, which can plug into these sources that teachers have, right? So like, can we think of new acquisition channels, but very product-led growth rather than like inorganic growth that marketing is doing? So insights really unlock a lot of things that you can do. Great advice. Before I let you go, this has been nothing short of great, but before I let you go, I want to, if you can quickly talk about what self-advocacy is and why it's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for asking. I think, so my book is on self-advocacy. Self-advocacy is speaking up for yourself and your best interests. So it's either proactive, where you intentionally position yourself in good ways that help your career, or it's reactive, where you see situations that are not great for you and you do something about it. So I think it's a super, super important topic. I've been speaking about it for almost 4 years at this point. And I especially think like people who are working in tech, it's not a skill that we are taught. We are not, we don't have classes in college that teach us how to negotiate or how to position ourselves better. And, you know, I grew up in India as well. It's not necessarily a skill that I was taught in culturally as well. So I hope people engage with that topic and find some value in it.
I'm sure they will. And very excited to read your book. So, Shalvi, thank you so much. It's been great having you on the show, and so much to take away from this. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was super fun. Thanks.
If you're interested in solving product case challenges or experiencing what a PM does by stepping into the shoes of a product manager in a live program, you should check out pmschool.io. If you like what you heard, do share this with friends, colleagues, and family members, and give us a rating on your favorite podcast streaming app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. We'll be back with another one very soon. Until then, stay curious and stay safe. This is your host, Arjav Jain, signing off.